All right. Good morning, December 17th, Tuesday, 2024. That means we're a week short of Christmas Eve, right? I guess Christmas will be on a Wednesday, so we will have a gathering on Christmas Eve, and then that means we'll also have a gathering on New Year's Eve because Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve always lined up, excuse me, I'll always wind up on the same day of the week, if I'm not mistaken. And I have been mistaken about some things in my life, although there's no record of it. So we will start with a period of about 20 minutes of meditation, and then there will be talking. Although there will be some talking during the meditation as well. So, but let's get started. Just settling in, whatever supports you in sitting and being mindful. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Certainly, no reason to look at me during the meditation. Just feeling how you're holding your body, balance and posture. You might take some longer or slower breaths. And having a sense of settling, of softening, releasing. Can you feel your body sitting? Sort of an odd question, but something that with practice we become adept at, just feeling our body. At first, it can seem like a actually challenging thing to do, to feel your whole body. When we're able to do that, we can recognize that there are many different sensations happening at once. And yet we can have this broad awareness that just feels it all as a field of energy, a field of sensations. In the center of that field is the breath. The movement of chest and belly. The touch of air entering and leaving the body. Our practice, in some ways, is one of attuning to more and more subtle experiences. So, just feeling the body and feeling the breath is the beginning of this process. These are experiences that we don't ordinarily pay attention to. There is a certain subtlety to them. as we become attuned to the body, to the physical sensations. We may find that we're able to bring awareness to more subtle realm of experience, the feeling realm. The feelings manifest in different ways. Their most obvious manifestation is as an emotion fully formed, moods, we see that there is a connection between body and feelings. They're not separate from each other. Feelings have a physical component. There's another component we can call emotional, but it doesn't necessarily have an identifiable emotion, so can just be called energy or feeling. Subtle. Something we ordinarily ignore or turn away from. This practice encourages us to turn toward and breathe with feeling. And then the realm of thought is also an area for us to bring awareness to. Thought is influenced by feeling and body sensations, but it is separate from them. Exists in a different realm, mental realm. The strong tendency is to identify with thoughts, to become wrapped up in thoughts, lost in thoughts. So a vital part of our practice is noticing that, and when we can, letting go. And for this, we can then return to the breath, to the body, to the feeling realm, the nonverbal realm. You might start to feel almost a push and pull among these realms. the mind wanting to take over, wanting our attention. Feelings. Unpleasant or pleasant, but certain resistance to feeling. And how the body reacts to all this restlessness or tension or ease and calm as we let go. We try to bring a quality of openness and acceptance to all these experiences. An interest and attention to the connections. And an overall kindness, gentleness, so that we aren't pushing ourselves or grading ourselves, judging ourselves, but bringing a kindness that understands that this mind-body process is inherently challenging to be with, generates dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. So we want to be gentle with ourselves. We see the damage we do ourselves. We push or judge or berate. We don't deserve that. We don't need that. Unnecessary. Accomplishes nothing. So the breath is breathed with kindness, this softness with ease. One moment, let me grab a book. Well, I hope everyone is well this morning, this whatever time of day it might be for you. Last week I was talking a little bit about a sort of contradictory, seemingly contradictory teaching that I had read in this book called Why We Meditate by Dan Goleman and Rinpoche. And I kind of came upon another kind of contradiction this morning that I thought would also lend itself to discussion. And I think I sort of have a place I want to go to with this. But so I'll start by that. So this is from a lovely book called The Zen Way of Recovery by Laura Burgess, who is a friend of mine. And I just saw her teaching this past weekend, and she is one of the people who founded the San Francisco Zen Center's Buddhist recovery group that's been going on for over 20 years. I actually, in One Breath at a Time, I described going on a day-long retreat with her at Green Gulch, San Francisco Zen Center out in Marin County. So somebody I've known a long time. And this is a relatively new book. I wrote a blurb for it. It's, let's see, Sun Shambhala. It came out last year, 2023. And really, really worth checking out, The Zen Way of Recovery. And her name is Laura. I will put her name in here because that's Burgess. And in any case, I came upon this quote from Suzuki Roshi, who was the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, best known for his book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is a book that every meditator should have on their shelf, and should actually not just have it on their shelf, recommended reading. So this quote from Suzuki says, in Zazen, leave your, so Zazen just means meditation in the Zen tradition. That's just sitting meditation. In Zazen, leave your front door and your back door open. Let thought come and go. Just don't serve them tea. So first of all, this typically kind of Suzuki often talks in this way, and obviously an image for meditating with kind of an open mind, that where you're not trying to stop your thoughts, you're just kind of letting them come through, like they come through, and they come through the front door and go leave through the back. You don't have to get stop them or get in their way. And it's interesting because it's an image that I've used in my teaching, how when we try to concentrate too much, it's like we are closing the front door, trying to stop the thoughts from getting in. But because we're focused so much on the front door, we don't realize that the thoughts are coming in the back door. And again, just an image for what it's like when you're meditating and in relation to thoughts. And this is, not to get too caught up in the imagery, but to, obviously it's meant to help you to sort of intuit how to work with what is a tricky thing, which is the which is thoughts and our relationship to thoughts, because they so easily take us over and we get lost in them. And then, yeah, we try to stop them or, interrupt them, and then we can wind up in this kind of conflict with our thoughts, which is a really particularly unhelpful thing and an unhelpful behavior, but one that's can easily get can easily seem like what you're supposed to do. Like many people get this idea that they're supposed to stop thinking, and so then when they are thinking, they're like trying to control that. And how can I stop thinking is one of the thought questions that people often ask in meditation classes. And as I usually respond to that, we're not trying to stop thinking. We're trying to change our relationship to our thoughts. So Suzuki is kind of describing one way of changing that relationship, that we're just letting them come through. But it's the last line that got my attention. And some of you who are familiar with Tara Brach will understand why I was struck by this line. Just don't serve them tea. Meaning, don't stop and like hang out with your thoughts and indulge in them. But why it came up as a contradictory teaching is that Tara Brach and this she takes this another Buddhist teaching. I'm not even really sure where it comes from. Maybe some of you guys know that says that you have tea with Mara. So Mara is the tempter, the devil in Buddhism, but just Mara is just like your troubling thoughts, right? So she's saying, have tea, go ahead, have tea with your thoughts. In a way, it seems like she's saying that. And her viewpoint is what she's getting at is like, don't fight with your thoughts. Don't judge your thoughts. Don't have an aversive relationship to your thinking. Just be like, oh, hi. I have a cup of tea. Don't. I think she would probably say like, don't let them move in. They can drop by. So it. If we were, the troublemakers, we would say, well, these are contradictory, like this is, whatever. And then we have to like decide who's right, right? Suzuki Roshi or Tara Brach, whatever. And of course that's not the point. It's to, find images, find ways of responding to our thinking that support us in this process, in this meditative process, which, as I was trying to form those words, what came to mind is like the question, what am I trying to accomplish? And I'm not sure I want to. That's not necessarily where I want to go, but and so I don't think either of these teachings is right or wrong. I think they both have their values and can and it's just a question of which one clicks for you, which one when you hear it. Like you go, yeah, right, that's helpful. And I think particularly with the Tara Brach one, you would probably want to read what she says about that, what she's taught, what she means by that. But where I get to with this, because I'm not, although I have used this imagery a little bit, I go to more, I think, simpler and more direct ways of talking about these things, which aren't so much using imagery, and that, so that what's important to me, or the way that I kind of work with my mental experience, is to see whether there is aversion there or grasping. And so this is a, particularly kind of Theravadin approach, where obviously Suzuki is a Zen teacher, and Zen tends to be more of a poetic kind of practice, right? The koan. But I'm a more of a literal person, and I like, sort of, although I get what he's saying, and I get what Tara's saying, I like, just like, okay, what does that mean? So don't invite it to tea. Don't get attached. Sit down and have tea is invite Mara to tea is don't be averse. So it's talking about the two main forms of that we create suffering: grasping and aversion. And to investigate those, and to use those as a model, or as the guides for what's going on. Like, what's happening right now? Am I, am I getting caught in one of these things? And we can see, like, the fact that these two wise teachers offer this sort of seemingly contradictory teachings, we can see that this is a tricky area that, our wish to just let things go, that's expressed in Suzuki's teaching, can easily bleed into aversion. Oh, just let it go, let it go, let it go, get out of here. Whereas the, oh, just let it in and don't be averse to it, can then bleed into, you think, anyway, bleed into, getting stuck in it, right? Being a, and typically, I would say, like, analyzing your thoughts, and, trying to process everything. I need to figure it all out. And so we see that, as with so many teachings, there isn't one thing that we can be told that solves everything. There isn't. It's we need a middle way. We need a way that's balanced. Then the question becomes, well, how do I get there? How do I avoid falling into one of these extremes? And the first answer to that question is very carefully, And that is the essence of it, which is with mindfulness, right? And because we can see that this is tied in with right effort. Like, how, if we're talking about how do I do something, then we're talking about effort. What's the work that I do? And right effort, like all the factors of the Eightfold Path, depends upon mindfulness. You can only know if your effort is skillful if you are mindful. And so that mindfulness, needs to be attuned on several levels. It needs to be attuned on the felt level. How does this feel? Because that really kind of tells you if there's a grasping, or if there's an aversion. You can kind of tune into that. But we're also being aware on the cognitive level, on the thought level, and watching, like, oh, what am I doing with my mind? And seeing that, what's the difference between letting the thoughts come in the front door and go out the back door and just hanging out thinking? Well, okay, that's the having tea with the thoughts, but it's not quite so simple, right? That you can be kind of letting the thoughts go through, but you can also be sort of rather than like they're just passing through, you can be kind of riding them through. Now I'm falling into these metaphors and images there. So all of this is the delicate process, and there and for me, I got to a point where I gave up trying to do it all perfectly. I mean, that's the one of the vital aspects of our intention. It's like, am I trying to attain some perfect meditative state right now? Well, that just right away is grasping. And then there's this balance about that. Like, am I just saying, oh, well, I can't attain anything, so I'm just going to hang out and do nothing, and I think that, for myself, I think that's become somewhat, if my imbalance is more towards the passivity, just letting and just not worrying about it, but it's just so, we each have to watch our own minds and see what our own tendencies are. I just find that it's so tricky and I would say difficult to apply effort without grasping an aversion, that my tendency and my default is to make le as little effort as possible. And it's not out of laziness, although maybe I don't think it is, but rather the to bring as much ease as possible to the process, to the meditative process. When the just to bring in a third factor of the Eightfold Path, I've talked about mindfulness and effort. This third factor, intention, right intention. I think that the blending of these three is really key to how we meditate. And so right intention has three elements to it. The first of them is the intention to let go. Bhikkhu Bodhi uses the term renunciation, which makes it a little bit more religious sounding, I think. So the language Bhikkhu Bodhi uses is renunciation, non-harming and non-ill will. But he redefines those second and third as a loving kindness and compassion. So the three elements of right intention are letting go, loving kindness, and compassion. And the idea then being that all of our thoughts, words, and deeds should be motivated by one or more of these qualities. And so when things go wrong, we can kind of reverse engineer, how did I get here? Well, I was either grasping or I was, angry or resentful, aversive. And so So this then points to why I really incline towards as little striving in my meditation as possible, because the first aspect of right intention is letting go. And how do you make an effort that's, that involves letting go? Like those two things, seem contradictory. Effort seems to be about making something happen. So this is the great challenge of meditation to me, is making an effort to let go. And that's why it has to be a very subtle effort, and why we have to be very careful and watch what we're doing. Because of course, if you are meditating, why would you sit down to meditate if you didn't have some wish to alter things, to control things, to do something, to make something happen? So that's right away, the fact that we're meditating, tends to mean that there is some efforting, and that there's some desire, that there's some wanting. So we're always playing with this edge here, to watch that. And that's where the mindfulness is so vital. And so this is why we can get these apparently contradictory teachings about having tea with your thoughts or with Mara. Should I have tea or should I not have tea? Well, there isn't an answer, right? You can only You're the only one who can know that in a given moment. And maybe halfway through the tea, you realize, oh, shouldn't have made that tea. Or else you're like, oh man, I really should have, they're gone. And you're like, oh, I should have invited them for tea. I missed out. So striving for perfection is, another way to create suffering. And yet, doing nothing is also a way to suffering. So, part of, I think, what I'm trying to do for you guys is, I guess, model how to deal with these kind of contradictions that we run into in the Dharma and in teachings, and recognize that we all want definitive answers to spiritual questions, and to see like those aren't really coming. In fact, I am particularly distrustful of definitive answers to spiritual questions. And I don't trust them. But and so we have to, investigate, inquire, look into these kind of contradictions, and try to have some way of resolving them. And again, this is, I think, why I find that the Eightfold Path, particularly the Four Noble Truths, and particularly the Eightfold Path, and understanding all the elements of the Eightfold Path, is the closest thing to a definitive answer we can get to spiritual questions. It's not that it gives us answers, it gives us the tools to find skillful moment by moment responses to the spiritual questions that arise. And I think, the response to both the contradictions that I talked about last week and these is to assume that both people are right. And then figure out how that can be true, that these apparently contradictory ideas, and that essentially they are answering different questions in a sense. The Sokni or Suzuki Roshi is answering the question of how to avoid clinging, and Tara Brach is answering the question how to avoid aversion. They're actually addressing that. They're giving answers that sound contradictory, but it's because the questions they are answering are opposite questions. So I don't know if that. There you go. That's what I'm offering today. It's what I got. Thank you. Nice to see everybody, and thank you, Monica, for. If anybody spends their time reading all the chat, then they won't have time to listen to my talk. But sometimes that might be, their pre your preference. So, but I will say that, what I'm seeing in the chat there at the end, there's my new book, Sought Through Meditation, which is that's nice. And one of the things that I created with that book was some guided meditations, and I had a hard time finding them on my website today. So, just for your benefit, I'm going to put a link in to that page. So on my website, on the page that describes the book, there's a little link. The book contains a collection of guided meditations. Here is the page with links to audio versions of these. So I was trying to find it for someone else this morning. And here is, let me just make sure this is going to everyone. So if you want, just these are like, full, short and longer meditations. There's a bunch of them on that page. And I hope that page is working. Let's see what's there. Yeah. There's a 20 minute, there's a 6 minute, there's a 10 minute. There's a bunch of them, and there's mindfulness, there's noting, there's mindfulness of breathing, there's sweeping metta, there's a couple of different metta ones, a forgiveness one. So hope that's helpful for people. And as oh yeah. As Monica dropped in, that you're also able to offer me Dana. Anyway, people, oh, question, hands are up. Let's see, Deborah, go ahead. You're still muted.
Okay, thank you. I love the chat. Love the Dharma talk. I think they're answering two different questions. It's the difference between the all caps thought and the little thoughts. Yeah, you gotta have those thoughts going in and out. And sometimes when you have that big all caps thought, then you offer tea. And that's when Tara says, do rain. And you investigate. And yes, the Eightfold Path is the only thing that is close to definitive answers. And it's really just the toolbox. And
Exactly.
the tea thing, it's personal and it's very situational. And no one can tell you when it's time to serve tea. You know it, or you don't. Sometimes you miss the chance. Maybe it comes around again. Maybe not. You're lucky if you can own. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much.
Okay, good summation. Thank you, Deborah. That's great. Hello, John.
Hey, Kevin. So, question, this is a sort of a technical question, I guess. You can have a technical question about meditation. But listening to you today and starting the practice, I'm sitting in an upright posture and relaxed and listening to your voice and kind of going through the different things. And all of a sudden, I get like a pain in my shoulder. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. I'm prepared for thoughts rambling through my head and, dozing off and all sorts of things. But I don't think in the process of doing this, I've sort of felt like a pain. And
Oh,
what,
too bad.
what, man, something to
You're missing out.
look forward to. Yeah, I'm missing out. Exactly. So I was just curious, what, I mean, I can sort of assume some things I can do, but I'd be interested to hear, from
Well,
a
physical pain is,
practitioner at length about.
yeah, no, physical pain I find to be one of the most helpful foci, things to pay attention to and to work with, because you immediately can recognize that there's aversion to it. And that aversion, learning to let go of aversion, is a really helpful tool. So the idea is to just take the attention into the sensation and explore it in a almost scientific way, just as sensations. And then the Buddha puts this in terms of the four elements: earth, air, fire, water. So earth element is the heaviness or density of some sensation. Fire element is the heat or the temperature of it. Air element is the movement aspect, and water element is the cohesion and fluid aspect of it. So, I mean, that's, a very, dry, ancient way of looking at it. But the main idea being, let me take apart the elements of this. Let me see what I can see. What am I experiencing? Because we have such instant aversion to unpleasant sensations that we never explore them. We don't take time to actually feel their what they're made of and what they really feel like and how bad they really are. So this is in the immediate aftermath of my knee surgery, this was my main practice, was just bringing attention into my knee and relaxing and allowing it to be there and seeing, how bad is that, And I'm very fortunate that it wasn't very bad. But, when I used to meditate with my legs crossed, my knees would burn. Actually, I had much more knee pain in meditation than I did after knee surgery, which is interesting. But I learned to just pay attention to it and see that when I relaxed and investigated it, rather than when I tensed and tried to get away from it, that when I relaxed and investigated, that it became much less painful, actually, and much less of a problem. It was manageable up to a point, and then there would be a point where I'd go, "Oh, now I need to move my leg." And then I would mindfully move it, and then I would feel the subsiding of the sensation. And it'd be very interesting because there's like, oh, this is pleasure. That the end of pain is pleasure. It's really a rich area for investigation. So first thing we want to do then is like, oh, I'm feeling this sensation. Where is it? What's it feel like? And so you also immediately see the what we call impermanence, but that's not a good word for the unstable nature of sensation. It's not solid, the non-solid nature of sensation. Again, we react to it as if it were a thing, a solid thing, but when we investigate it, we see that it's in constant motion. Throbbing, pulsing, moving, growing, shrinking, and it's like, wow, it can be very interesting. And at a certain point, you say, okay, this isn't really manageable, perhaps, and you change your posture. Now, on a practical level, typically, if there is back pain, in meditation, it means that you're not sitting in a fully aligned posture. You're probably tipping forward or to one side or the other, or back, because if you lean back, you strain certain parts of the back. If you lean forward, particularly, I had this experience a lot on retreats because I typically, when I'm meditating for long periods, my head tilts forward and I start to pull on the muscles in my upper back, and you start to have sensations from that. So it's also something you can do, not to just say, oh, well, I've got back pain, too bad, but to, work on your posture a little bit and just notice when you're more aligned. And because when you're aligned, then everything just the weight of your head, because it's really the problem is your head, like as it is so often. It's the weight of your head pulling that causes the problem on the back and the back. And so when your head is aligned with your shoulders and your spine and your hips, then the weight winds up down in your butt, right? Which is like a nice place. It's got plenty of flesh to just hold it, right? Although that'll start to hurt too after a while, but that's only after hours of meditation. So, the painful butt.
Thanks, Kevin. That was very
You're
helpful.
welcome. All right. We're gonna keep going. It's 11:05, but Forrest, go ahead. Nice to
Oh,
see you again.
Kevin, can you hear me all right?
I can.
Yeah. First, I just express my gratitude for these Tuesday discourses. I very much enjoy them. Where my thoughts went when during your discourse discussing this is a place that my mind often goes in meditation. And the question of, was Siddhartha craving enlightenment? And, I end up kind of the best of a place is just it's kind of a paradox and just not trying to figure it out. So I just wonder if you'd comment on that at all.
Well, certainly if we read the text about how he describes his own journey, it's clear that early on in the process, that's exactly what was happening, and that was what caused him so much trouble. That he was striving so hard that he almost killed himself. He almost starved himself to death, thinking that that was a way to become enlightened. And it was when he let go of that striving that he has the breakthrough. So, yes, the Siddhartha was striving for enlightenment. And when he let go, that's when he became the Buddha in this, simplest terms. But that's how the story plays out. Yeah.
What I do get from that story is that if he hadn't been striving, he wouldn't be able to let go.
And indeed, he built up a tremendous amount of concentration and, inner strength in that striving, no doubt. And so this is, again, one of the contradictions we're faced with, I think that the contradiction is apparent, that we need to make effort, and yet if we're efforting in an unskillful way, it gets in the way. But, there is this heroic effort that can have heroic results potentially. We don't, that's not really the way the Dharma is offered in Western lay settings at this point in history. But when I started to practice 40, 43, 44 years ago, there was much more of that kind of I imagery and presentation of practice as a heroic, the term the warrior's path, That was much more of the way it was offered. But a lot of Dharma teachers saw that most Westerners turned that into a way to create suffering for themselves. Nonetheless, if you look at a monastic lifestyle, they're trying to mimic that kind of balance between wholehearted effort that is not. Does not have grasping in it, and it's a lot. It's a big commitment. Oh, good question. All right. Jimmy D for the to wrap it up.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for the Dharma talk. got a Dharma teacher here in Atlanta, and not only does he say invite them for tea, but tea and cookies. So, but
So is he working with people with eating disorders? Because
I don't know. I don't
I
know,
would
but
not recommend that.
he's a retired psychiatrist, so it's kind of like and he doesn't say it's pretty much like any thought, and I'm kind of like I come from the Zen tradition. For me, it's kind of the I'm like, well, I'm more of leave the door open and in the front and back and let them go, you know. Now, if one hangs around and keeps coming back, then I'll say, you know, it's kind of like, okay, have a seat, but bring your own tea. I
Fair.
don't know. It's kind of a.
Yeah, and and frankly, I think most of you guys are become aware that the main focus of my practice and as well as my teaching is not even on thoughts themselves, but on the underlying feelings beneath the thoughts, because that's where the real trouble is. When if you ask somebody, I mean, well, put it another way, how do we define happiness? I think most of us define happiness by how we feel, and then our thoughts come out of that. But I don't define happiness as, oh, I have a lot of happy thoughts. Like I can all have all the happy thoughts in the world and still be depressed as hell, you know? Like the thoughts are not the way to happiness. The feeling realm is the realm that's the problem realm and is also the solution realm. So that's why what these two teachings are talking about is not really thoughts. What they are talking about is desire and aversion, which are feelings. They aren't thoughts. The thoughts are just the outward manifestation of the desire and the aversion. And they're trying to help you deal with the desire and the aversion. And it's not the thoughts at all that's really the question. Now that's quite a, how about that for that's my mic drop right there.
Was good. I liked it.
Sorry. Oh, I see. I see why it was off before I pressed the mute button. Okay, kids. Happy December 17th. I'll see you on Christmas Eve. And if you're in the Bay Area or you're planning to come to the Bay Area, please come to Spirit Rock on December 29th and we'll have a jolly old day together.
Okay.
Okay.
Namaste.
Right.
Thanks, Kevin.
Blessings.
See you next time.
Okay. Hope you're doing all right there, Steve.
Doing good. Thank you.
All right.
See you Tuesday.
Thanks.